Ben, good morning from Utah. I'm sitting right down the road from you in Utah. It's snowpacked and it's, oh man, it is beautiful here. You and I got to do a training yesterday together. Super fun.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Yeah, it
It's
was
fun to
good
get back
stuff.
into it. It's been a few months since we've done one, so it was great.
It has been. It's always fun to get on the podium and shake it up and talk a little bit. Hey, today's guest, the interview. Although my part, I got had some Wi-Fi issues. Man, it what an incredible guest Vicky Newman is.
Yeah. No, Vicky was great. I think she brought something a little bit different from obviously some of our other guests, and she showed up and laid it out there. Yeah, we don't always get to hear the spouse perspective, but she showed up, took a risk on us and the process, and told us a little bit about her journey, some lessons that she's gained from this process, and really enjoyed her kind of talking and even role modeling a little bit about what spouses can and sometimes need to think about, tough conversations and kind of growing up emotionally and figuring out how you want to save this marriage. It's really cool.
I did miss, I think maybe, 10, 15 minutes of it, with some of my trouble, but what I got to hear, and of course you and when I got back on, you and she were in a fascinating conversation. And, what I found coming back to the table was you really are, she's giving this other perspective that we don't often hear, of, hey, here's my side of the story. Here's what's
Yeah.
going on over here. And I just thought it was fascinating. I think the listeners are going to have a great time.
Yeah, I think they'll love it because I think there's way too many messages out there about here's my message, but it's told from purely kind of a victim's perspective. And she's offered something that is mature, accountable, hope, purpose, just good things that all of us kind of aspire to do. But it was really cool to have her role model a little bit for us. It was cool.
Well, I love her. I've watched her build. I've known her for most of the build of How to Love Our Cops, and I've watched her build this organization, and it's been such a delight. I'm proud of her. I consider her a good friend. Her and Brent, her husband, both good friends of mine, and watching them build this organization together has been amazing because I think she's doing incredible work. But with that being said, how about you and I not talk anymore? We just get into the podcast. Listeners,
Yep.
look forward to the next interview with Vicky Newman.
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. Today we have Victoria Newman, Vicky, better known as Vic to me. Vicky and I have known each other a long time, and Vicky has been a great friend and has a wonderful organization. Good morning, Vicky. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I love having you here. And you're just half of this great deal. I mean, Brent, your husband, is the other half. What an amazing guy. He's not here, so I can talk good about him. I hate to talk good about him in front of him, but he is an amazing dude, retired chief, California Highway Patrol, instructor in many areas, great from the podium, just all around great guy. And then you as well, compliment that in such great fashion. So great to have you on here, Vic.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here to talk about this kind of, families and how to love our cops all day long.
Tell us a little bit about more about your backstory.
So I grew up with no law enforcement whatsoever, and in my background, except for maybe one little stint in the back seat of a patrol car, but we won't talk about that here.
Ooh, juicy.
But no, Brent's father was CHP, And when we started dating, we had a lot of plans that really didn't include law enforcement. And then it just kind of, I feel like we were just kind of led to that and started our marriage. He went into the Highway Patrol Academy 5 weeks after we got married. Wow. And so I knew him before, and I saw him change. We moved down to LA. That's where all the law enforcement, the CHP officers go when they graduate the academy. At that time, actually, it was either Southern California or the Bay Area, as we call it, San Francisco area. And so we elected to go down to Southern California, and I saw him change. Didn't really know what that meant. And, you know, he was agitated when he'd come home, and I didn't understand. And, you know, back in the dark ages, that was 1985. So, 1988. So it was like, nobody to talk to. So I did ask somebody, hey, are you seeing any changes in your officer, you know, agitation or language or, you know, this kind of thing. And they were like, no, I have no idea what you're talking about. So I just said, well, you know, I'm just gonna buckle down and be a good wife, and we'll see how this goes. And then I found out that she left her husband like 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. So it was, you know, at that point I went, huh, there is something different about law enforcement marriage. There is something different than what I grew up with. And so I'm going to just try and learn. And, you know, we saw divorces, suicides all around us down there. It was crazy. And I just, you know, didn't know what to do. So, you know, fast forward, you know, we brought 4 children into the world, and really amazing little kids, 2 girls, 2 boys. And I was a wife, mom, homeschooled some because of the schedule. We wanted them to know their dad. And so we elected to homeschool for a time, and moved all over California. And then at one point I was done, and you know, I was starting to learn more about suicide and how that was a problem within the law enforcement community. I was learning. And
now, can I ask a little bit of clarifying question of that? Like, when you say you're done, are you talking about you're done with the culture, you're done with playing the game, you're done with your marriage? Like, what does that mean when you say I'm done?
Well, I'm learning all these things, but I didn't realize it, but I'm seeing it in my own home too. And I was slow to figure out that he was truly affected by the things that he was seeing and experiencing on duty. And he's an amazing man. But I saw him change early on, and then it was a slow, cumulative trauma that I was seeing. And so I think probably we're married 18, 19, 20 years, somewhere around there. And I was tired. And so even though I had, you know, given a vow, I was just really, really tired and started thinking all about myself and not realizing that this was something that was really, that he was going through and that he needed me. I'm like, yeah, I don't like the way that he's treating me. And so I actually was planning to leave. And that was when I was writing my first book. So I'm learning a lot of things, doing research and learning all about the law enforcement life, and that this was something, you know, some of the things that I was, well, most of the things that I was experiencing in my own home were happening in homes across, you know, all these other people. We were all experiencing a lot of the same things. And so I had a tear-filled night on the beach and a conversation with God, and decided that I was going to stay. And then I realized just the following week, he came to me and said, I am struggling with depression and I don't know what to do. And at that point, I'm like, well, I'm with you. And, you know, super excited. In fact, you know, that was 14, probably more than that now, but that was 2010. So we're at 15, about 15 years since. And, you know, even my kids and I, we talk about, gosh, just think if you would have left, how the things that we have in our families now and the relationship that I have with Brent now, it's rich, it's deep, it's beautiful. And our kids too. And we're reaping the the benefits, I should say, not consequences, but the benefits of a choice to hang on and stay in the fight. And so, and after that, I just started really learning about just how I could help and how I could come along. And some of that comes from you, Brad. I learned a lot from you of just how this career really truly affects our officers. And it is hard to love a cop, but when you figure out how to learn and when you realize the depth of the pain and the effects, it can be done. It's hard, but it can be done. So that's.
Can I ask you a question about the comments you made about Brent came to you with the topic of depression and saying, I think I'm depressed and I don't know how you said that exactly verbatim, but what, looking back on that, we talk a lot about courage in this space, about these little moments of courage and just making this courageous moment. Given the time era you were offering up and the culture and community and how acceptable it was to actually step up and raise your hand and say, I'm not doing well. How does that moment look to you today?
Incredibly vulnerable, because we were not in a good spot. But it switched from me to we. And that's probably my personality of just knowing, you know, I felt empathy right away, but it connected me to him because I was under this impression that he was just being kind of a jerk, you know, an a-hole. I mean, and didn't care about me and my feelings. And because he was not nice. He was not being nice to me. And nothing abusive, but it was just this, you know, constant where I'm, you know, hello, you, I'm here. And, you know, and he was constantly agitated and things. So, but for me, so I started really looking inward and saying, you know, I need to not be treated this way. And so when he had that moment of vulnerability, he trusted me with that. He trusted me with something that he was going through that came from his heart that was difficult. And in that is courage. That is courage to offer to somebody to say, I am struggling. And for me, it was like, oh, this is not me. This is we. So let's work together on this. And we didn't even know what we were doing at the time. I mean, we do now much more so, but I'm just like, oh, well, if he needs me, I'm here, you know, because I love my guy and I am committed. And you know, I'll be honest with you. It didn't, you know, he still was treating me yucky here and there, but then I knew because of that little moment of vulnerability, that it wasn't me. It was something that he was going through. And since then, Brent and I have come up with, I think it was his term that he coined. I don't think he heard it anywhere, but basically the way that we look at our relationship now is one team, one fight. And what that means is that, you know, we can be individuals, and when problems come and we're treating each other crappy, we're fighting, you know, there's that fight. But more often than not, it's outward things. You know, it's depression, it's cancer, it's too much overtime. It's, you know, all the things that cause conflict in our lives, that and in our relationships, that if we were to join arms together and understand that this is not necessarily us, but it's something that we can join arms and have compassion for each other, and then fight it together. So like depression or PTSD, or, you know, all of those things. I think one thing that is hard for spouses, and myself included, is that PTSD, you know, these things that we're having conflict over, depression, long hours, no sleep. I mean, those kinds of things that we are dealing with within the law enforcement profession. And I dare say even the first responder, not just officers, but first responders, is that it affects us. and it encroaches on the things that, you know, our daily lives. And usually there's not either a knowledge of that or an admonition. Admission of that, of where, because we're two individuals that are fighting against each other instead of coming together as we and fighting, you know, whatever it is that the problem is, and trying to solve that problem. And so, you know, I think that's probably why it's important to me in what I do with How to Love Our Cops, is to educate, encourage, and equip spouses and other family members to know, you know, what this career does to a person, to a human being, and the expectations that we have of our officers is unrealistic. You know, we expect them to just kind of move along without, you know, after seeing so many things over and over again and dealing with such evil, and then not just evil, not everybody's evil, but the mad, bad, sad people that, you know, you're seeing people on their worst days, and it can be so negative. And if you don't have anything positive, well, then it just spills over onto
everything,
the spouse and the kids.
Yeah.
And everywhere, actually. Yeah, right. You're right.
I had a quick question for you, Vicki. There was a piece in there where you'd kind of commented that as what happens in marriage, there's a lot of hurt, a lot of disappointment, a lot of fear, a lot of, you know, when you're treated poorly, you know, how does that not turn into pain and anger and all of that stuff? And you're talking about a moment that is pretty interesting, because, and you made a decision that I'd like for our listeners to hear a bit more about, because I think there's moments where I meet spouses in this process, and they are pretty done, pretty discouraged. Yeah. And the effect for them was, all I see is my pain. I don't even understand what's kind of cumulatively happening to my spouse and how they've evolved from what you describe as he was my guy to he kind of turned into a different guy. He was still my guy, but you know, there's a change there, and it's like, hey, what happened? This is not the agreement, right? Which all newlyweds kind of have this assumption, like we're going to capture this moment forever and we're never going to evolve or change or regress or whatever. So how did you, I hear you making the decision about, you know, the vows and choosing to stay. How did you deal with some of the anger and frustration and stuff that had kind of built up over the years? Where did that go, and what helped you feel a little peace or let go of some chunks of that so that you could show back up in the marriage and learn like you've learned?
Three things, or I should say three groups of people, I should say. God, I mean, you know, my faith, being a woman of faith, I really do draw from a relationship with God every morning. He loves me, and I really concentrate on that every morning. And so that's why I wasn't horribly angry. I mean, I was angry.
Sure. And everyone who's listening will be like, yep, damn straight, you should be.
Right. Yes. And there was great pain.
Right.
You know, in some ways. And so I basically retreated, you know, under the wing of God for a time, you know, during that time, and prayed a lot. Brent loves, I call it tattling. So I would journal and I would tattle on him. I'm like, will you please deal with this? Because he's doing this and he's doing that. And it was therapeutic because it's not going to go anywhere, right? It's, right. You know, I'm not smearing him to right, a whole right. bunch of people. But so that was part of it. And then it was my kids. You know, Brent came from a divorced home, you know, and that was very painful for him. And I didn't want my kids to have to deal with that. And especially because they were all young. And wow. So third is, you know, I really do love this guy. And if I think that he doesn't love me, well, then I can go all day of just anger and, you know, I could torch the place, seriously.
And once you start looking for it, you're always going to find it. You're always going to find this little thing, this little situation, the family, the job, the whatever. It's there's a gravitational pull within our culture and just as humans for us to want to defend and protect. And in order to do that, we have to find the threat.
Yes.
And so that's pretty typical.
Of course. And but when he was vulnerable with me, and then I saw that he would, then of course my love for him, then I want to protect him and I want to help.
Sure.
And that's, so that comes from just my love for him. And so that was, I think those three things are what kept me from spiraling. It's interesting. I've been dealing with several couples lately, just like in the last few months, of these spouses who really care about their officers, but their officers are the ones who are done. And there's a couple of them who have had affairs. So they've searched elsewhere and, yep. You know, they're out. But there's one in particular where the spouse and I are just praying together because there's nothing that we can do because he's not willing to even look at the fact that he is, you know, he's been through several critical incidents. He's, you know, he's dealing with grief. He's lost some officer, you know, some friends. He's lost, I think, his father or something. And so there's grief and there's trauma and there's, you know, he basically is targeted in on her as being the problem. And if that were the case for us, I'm not sure that we would have made it.
Sure.
it's that vulnerability and the openness to say, I need help.
Yeah.
There's something not right inside of me. And instead of blaming and, you know, deflecting,
sure.
Just taking responsibility and going, you know what, something's wrong. It may be you, it may be us. Maybe we need to get a divorce, but before we do that, let's get help. Let's go to Chateau Recovery, or let's go to a counselor. Figure out what the problem is, join together, and then fight together against, you know, to solve this problem. And that's, you know, that's what I hope. But if an officer is not willing to do that, that's why we see divorce.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Now, you make great points. I see a piece of this, well, constantly, but there is this element, it feels like part of our job in treatment or as professionals is say, hey, please take a chance. Just consider that a little bit of it might be you, and there's hope and there's potential, but it's a big moment for someone to say, I need something more. But yeah, I love that you said that, because especially given that time, for someone to raise their hand and say, I need something, especially in a mental health way, but we need something, I need extra. I think that's such a huge step forward. But I think that is a big fear for a lot of men who are, you know, a big chunk of this culture. They're under the impression, which happens in all sorts of parts of our culture, that if I draw any attention to this, that is the beginning of the end. So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to stuff it down, and I'm going to wait, and I'm going to procrastinate, or I'm going to blame. I'm going to do all these kinds of things, but I'll try everything but ask for help, hoping for obviously some different kinds of, you know, results. But no, I love that he did that. And I think those are the stories that don't get heard enough, of both people in the relationship, exhausted, tired, discouraged. All of them have a list. All of them are comparing notes of who's worked harder, who's done more. And it is incredibly attractive to find some reason, the shiny object. It was funny, I was talking to a group yesterday during a presentation about the overlap between us being exhausted and in survival mode, and literally operating from a different part of your brain. And in those moments, shiny objects are really tough to say no to.
Yeah.
And that shiny object might be a new phrase, a new substance, a new experience, more overtime, like you said. Like, those are tough things. And it does take a ton of that positivity and that hope and that humility to say, I can wait. Let's do the harder thing first.
Yeah.
So has Brent talked to you over the years about what it took for him to speak up in that moment, or?
No, we've never really, I mean, he hasn't talked about that necessarily, but I know he was under a lot of stress, during that time. He was actually overseeing the academy, California Highway Patrol Academy. So he's the guy in charge, and we've got furlough Fridays going on. He's got the largest classes that they've ever had, because they were trying to ramp up, you know, the number of officers on the road. And I mean, there were a couple of years where he had like 500 cadets.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a small city.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we were losing officers. So anytime we lose an officer, we go to the academy, we have a bell ringing ceremony. And then the academy is very much involved. We have a fountain in the center of the academy that has all the names on it. And that's where we do, you know, the memorials and different things. Right. So he was constantly in a fishbowl, but constantly under trying to solve so many issues, and not getting great support during that time. Sure. And so, you know, and of course no names, but it was incredibly stressful. And then, you know, under a promotional, he was about to get a promotion as well. So he had to study, and things were just not going well. And of course he and I are tussling and, sure. you know, arguing, and the kids, we've got, you know, a couple of them were teenagers. I mean, you know,
yeah,
it was just like,
yeah.
So that's a lot. And I think probably some money issues too, when the kids start going into, you know, sure. high school and things like that, the expenses skyrocket. And so it was just, yeah, it was just a lot of pressure. And we have talked about that.
Yeah.
At the times where he has, you know, and that wasn't the last time, you know, that we had sure. issues
right.
for sure. But it was the last time that I said that I was going to go.
Right.
Because I recognized it from then on. And there were some really hard seasons even after that we went through, and we did it well. You know, I mean, I was supportive. He was, you know, and as you go higher in the ranks, you have less and less people to talk to. So he started talking to me because I can keep it quiet. And so we just started working more and more together. And, you know, now that he's retired, he's been retired 5 years, a little over 5 years now. And we're still learning how to be that one team, one fight.
Right.
And now I've got more of a career where it's more demanding, and he's doing a lot of things. So he's working a lot, but my role at Heidelberg Cops is because we're growing, and it's getting very stressful at times.
Sure.
And so now we've switched. So he's supporting me, and not necessarily through trauma, but, you know, we have this, you know, we've traded positions now.
Right.
So now he has the empathy. And so occasionally we'll talk through some of the things of looking back and, you know, when he was going through things, and this is what I did, or I didn't understand, or I didn't do. And so we'll have those conversations, and it's been interesting.
Yeah. I imagine interesting is probably a euphemism, but I want to make sure we spend some time talking about how some of these books have evolved, and obviously get to more of these changes and how the organization is working. I do want to take just a second before we move on from your guys' journey to I think a question that I get a lot, and that is, after someone speaks up and says, I need better, and it's a good boundary, it's a honest, clear line that has been drawn. I think that's really important in just healthy relationships, not just at the end, but how do we do that more often and more consistently and more empathically? But what advice might you have for someone who has spoken up and said, this has got to be different, this has got to be better? And in those early days of kind of rebuilding, any pieces of advice or encouragement? And maybe you're talking about that when you get into your books and things like that, obviously. But yeah, what advice would be for those who have taken this leap of faith that, you know, I got to do something?
Yeah.
And then the awkward pause that happens after that. What advice do you have for them?
Well, as a couple, first of all, there's tons of resources available, and so it is a humbling thing. So we need to understand that as we go through a humbling fixing, if you will, you know, a humble sure. road that goes towards health again. That little piece of vulnerability that, you know, kind of opens that door, there still needs to be that vulnerability and the empathy together. But also realizing that you're probably going to need others too. So it's not just the two of you, you're going to need to bring in help. So whether it be a mental health professional or, you know, a rehab facility, you know, and that journey, or a post-critical incident seminar, whatever the road, and maybe all of them, you know, I don't know, but being open to have that vulnerability along the way, but also dignity. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when someone says, I need help, you want to help have them also have some dignity. So that's a big choice for a loved one to say, okay, all right, here we go. We're jumping in this boat, but let's put aside, you know, a lot of times the marriage, a lot of the things that will help the marriage is the actual getting well from, you know, whatever it is, whether it be substance abuse or, you know, PTSD. But realizing that it's a journey of vulnerability, a journey of humility and humbling, but yet keeping respect and dignity intact. That comes from character.
That's such a great point. I've not heard in the integrity part. Like you said, I think this idea of how do I honor this person that took a leap, and they're in this really vulnerable spot. How do I allow them to still have their dignity? I think a lot of times what we see is someone who's kind of laid out an ultimatum, saying this has got to be different. And then they take their foot off the gas and just wait for them, the other person, to make all the changes. And that typically does not go well. But this idea of how do we be patient, but also find ways to help them still save face, you know, keep their integrity and to be proud of what they've done, even though they're making the best out of a bit of a mess. That's such a cool concept. I haven't heard it like that. That's a cool idea.
Well, and it is a mess, and there are many feelings and hurts. One of the things that we have been doing since Brent retired is I had a trench that I had dug around myself. And this was for my preservation, if you will. And I've told him about this, where I've got a trench dug around me so that any of this negativity, this treatment, you know, will go down into the trench so it doesn't reach me. So, and in some ways it's a trench. I call it a trench, but there's a separation. So we're doing this together, but I have to still protect myself. So as we go through that, I had to fill in that trench. And I think we're pretty much there by now. Because, you know, of relearning to trust as he has gotten better and has realized, you know, some of the things that were said and done back then. And, you know, we've had to have those hard conversations afterwards. And it's just, you know, for that, those are hard conversations, but at the same time, we've got goals in mind that we want to honor each other. We want to love each other. We really don't want a trench or a wall between us. We want to, let's unravel that. Let's take down the bricks together. But that requires vulnerability and respect and, you know, a sensitivity as well. It has not been easy, but it is doable. But we have to be, I mean, yes, for the officer, it's to get help is very courageous. But for the spouse, it's very courageous to say, all right, you've wronged me, but I'm going to forgive you. And I'm going to keep on forgiving you, and we're going to build trust together. because it's not just, oh, I forgive you, you know, let's just forget all of this happened. No, because actually there's great wisdom and character that happens in those moments. If you allow pain to have its way, you know, just like a workout, if you allow pain to have its way and not become bitter, but actually offer forgiveness and walk in that, that is a very hard, courageous move. And, but it is one that, if traversed, it can bring great joy.
Yeah. Well, I think it's essential, right? I love this idea that each party is responsible for figuring out how to fill that in and doing it consciously. I think that's one of those moves that is behind the scenes a little bit, because I think in our pain sometimes, and again, there's all sorts of social media these days that has, you know, a lot of advice about how it's supposed to go. And when we get into the heart of kind of blaming and being angry and bitter, we think the other person is supposed to do such a great job of reading our minds and doing all the extra effort. They should be figuring out how to rebuild themselves and take care of themselves and fill in my moat perfectly without any instructions from me. And I love that each person gets to make this decision, show up and do it. And that forgiveness is a process that, as you're saying, like, this might be years to fill in this and take down that and do those kinds of things. And you need to have a vision that, hey, that's where I want to be as a person, not just this is what I deserve from this marriage now that this person wronged me back in 88, right?
Yeah. And probably all the years since, you know.
Yeah, right. No, I just love that idea, because I think when it's out of balance, I think people just stay unhappy. And you're kind of giving this testimonial about, like, hey, if you hang in there, do those kinds of things that are not just about them, but it's about me cleaning up my side, me having to be humble. What a great role model that is for a lot of folks, because they're not sure how to rebuild that. In our culture right now, there's a lot of attention on be brave and do that one big move and say, you know, demand something different, which is a great move. But this other stuff you're talking about is like you said, a greater step towards something just very fundamentally different and happier. That's really cool.
For sure. But I think maybe the reason why it's so hard and it does take courage is because maybe there's some things that I can do better. You know, maybe there's some things that I wronged him or her. And so it is a humility on both sides, not just, you know, like, you've done all the wrong, and so you got to go. I mean, I've heard this from spouses. Just go get fixed.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll just wait. You know, I'll be here. I'm going to do my thing. I've got my career. I've got the kids. You go get fixed and then come back when you're better. And it's this, but that scares me, because, you know, it's really hard. And I've seen this couple go through some difficulties in, you know, one particular couple that I have in mind. I mean, it's been really hard because he's felt alone.
Sure.
And it's hard to walk that road to health alone.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, I've seen officers, if their spouse does not get on board, then they find somebody who will. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of it. And it breaks my heart, because that's certainly not the answer, but there's culpability, you know? And I mean, I'm not saying that an affair is all one person's fault. I mean, it's the spouse. Please hear me, what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. But really, when there are issues in the marriage, it is both people. It's not always one.
Right.
So yeah. And that was, I had to learn some things, you know. I realized that, you know, I was making a lot about me. And then when I finally intentionally said, it's us, it's we rather than me.
Right.
That was the key.
That's huge. No, I like that idea because there's usually what brings people to their knees in relationships is both of them have felt alone for some time. And I think this part of, hey, you go get fixed. And here's the justifications of why you owe me. Those are tough conversations. And sometimes they're essential. I think there are some good conversations that need to happen there. The part that I see a lot is alone people make a big move to try and stop the pain. And then one turns into the judge. And then I'll let you know when you've fixed enough and when you've done enough, which is just a different version of being alone in a relationship for both parties.
Yeah.
So it's tough to go against that because there are many messages in our culture of stick it to them and then keep the focus on them. And obviously you're making some big moves to try and help people get out of that by writing these books and talking about how they can make an impact on the larger system, not just these particular moments. They're pivotal and important, but it's got to be a bigger system change.
Well, and I think there's so much that we don't know as spouses. You know, it's so different than when Brent and I started. I mean, back then it was the dark ages. It was just, you know, choir practice. That was it, you know. And but over the years, it's been a journey of learning for me. And I really wish that I would have known. I remember Brad and I having a conversation. I think we were on a Zoom during 2020, and we were asking him about how to, you know, how do we help our officers who are coming? You know, it's 2020, right? It's crazy. It's horrible. And how do we do? And I remember him talking about the amygdala and all this, and it was hilarious. And people talk, you know, spouses talked about it for months afterwards. Brad, we should probably do something, another one of those, but
the honking horn. That was the honking horn.
You know that. I mean, yeah. it was a joke, but it was our reality. So we kept doing that. But just the whole idea of, I remember you had said, Brad, that it was just hand him a bottle of water when he walks through the door. There's toxins that are dumping. And I'm like, I wish I would have known that. That would have been so easy. That is easy to just start. Because you know what that says? That says, I'm with you and I understand. And it says, I love you. And I understand what this job is doing. It's throwing you around. It's producing all kinds of stuff in your body. And I have got this awesome bottled water for you. Drink it and, you know, take what time you need. And I've got dinner on the stove. I mean, you know, those kinds of things. And
because it's more than just a bottle of water. It's a lot more than a bottle of water.
It is. Yeah, it is. And it's something that we can do that's very simple. Walk to the fridge, take it out and hand it, you know, with a hug. I was flabbergasted when I heard that for the first time, because I'm like, oh my gosh, all those years I could have been doing something like that would have communicated that I'm on your team. And that was so easy. And that's why we need, I'm talking about spouses, family members, even kids, you know, adult kids. We need to know what we know, what we don't know, and how we can help and how we can support, because then it's a team effort and no one walks alone. Well, you say not. No one fights alone, and it's very, very, very important. That is how I believe how we're gonna knock out the suicide. That is how we're gonna, or at least reduce it. That is how we're gonna knock down the divorce rate. That is how we're going to have healthier officers, first responders on our streets, That is how we're going to solve the issues that we have with officer wellness. I believe that we're the missing link. And it's because we've been held in the dark. We've been separated, you know, even academies themselves will say compartmentalize, you know, you don't want to get your family involved, you know, and then an officer doesn't want to bring it into the home. So they leave it, they stuff it, so I don't want to bring all that stuff home. Brent used to say, I went through it. It was hard enough one time. I don't want to go through it again by sharing it. But it comes out in other ways. And that's what I don't think a lot of officers understand, is it comes out in agitation. It comes out in, you know, hypervigilance, where I'm ignoring my kids, where I don't even hear them. I don't even see them. They're invisible to me because I'm so locked into this malaise after my shift. And I just want the TV. And so it comes out in other ways, even if you don't say a word. And it comes, and that's why when you have somebody who finally goes to rehab, or, you know, and you've got a family at home that says, I'm done. I am so done. Okay, so you're getting help. Good for you. You know, you owe me, right? It's, you know, it's that piece where it's like, it came out in other ways and the officer never saw it. And it was hurting. It was pain. It was, you know, and it's a lot of times years, because I think Gottman said that we finally get help like 7 years too late. Yeah. And by that time you have a deep trench or a high brick wall that is almost impossible to take down. And so, yeah, I mean, we've got some problems, but I think it starts with education. And that's, you know, that's what I do with my team, with How to Love Our Cops. That's why the book came out, Chip on My Shoulder. That was from, because I was learning about suicide. CHP had lost 14 officers to suicide in 4 years, but it was incrementally coming quicker. And so we were seeing a high suicide rate. Nobody's talking about it. And so I wasn't even talking about it. I heard it. Brent was getting texts. He would tell me, oh yeah, we lost another officer. But for me, it was like, wait, okay, stop. Everybody just stop. What are we doing here? And this was back in 2006. So I'm like, what? And, you know, the CHP, to their credit, they started talking about suicide for the first time. And we didn't see any suicides for a long time because people, they made a way for people to get help. And that was leadership. But for me, it was, what can I do? And, you know, I saw a lot of marriages falling apart, and our own marriage, and, you know, different things that we had been through. So I put together the book, Chip on My Shoulder. And that's where things started for me, because I did research, I did interviews, I was learning a heck of a lot and having a lot of ahas. But in the midst of because that's when I was thinking of leaving. Sure. So it's just this crazy time. But the book came out, and then I started hearing stories from gals across the United States. And it was like, whoa, all right. Well, I've had it kind of easy, actually. And then I started speaking, and we put together a wounded officer retreat up in Montana for a time, and just joining with other women, primarily, to let's talk about this. Let's support one another. Let's get educated. And then I was hearing, well, you know, it takes two. So, you know, what about him? Why don't you write a book for him? And so I did. That was hard. That took me three times as long. Learned a lot and had some ahas in my own my own marriage in that of just learning. That's when I really started getting the hypervigilance piece. And so as it went on, I think 2016 is when things were crazy in the country. And we had some political things through Brent's work, and they decided that they didn't want my books in the PX anymore, to kind of dig at him for some political decisions. And it was really hard, where I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm done. And so I started praying about that, and God said, no, I'm not done. You're just getting started, but you need to not do this alone anymore. You know, no one fights alone. And so I joined with, I think it was four others, women, and we started How to Love Our Cops. And the first thing that we did was come alongside of 145 families that lost their homes in the Paradise Fire, when Paradise burnt down. And we just kind of started running from there. And it's been, we've got conferences, we've got a peer support helpline that we do. Through 2020, we really learned that, you know, people need connection. And so we did, with Brad and others, we did we went to online, we learned Zoom and brought on different speakers, and that really helped people through those really lonely, isolated times in 2020 and 2021. And so we started doing book clubs in the same way after that. And we don't do those anymore because people are kind of tired of Zoom, but we do other things. So we've got a lot of things that we're doing for new officer families right now. We're doing a lot. I could say, or just tick off all these things.
That's awesome.
But we're just responding to the needs that we see. In 2022, you know, for all those years that I was in, you know, helping spouses behind, I mean, I'd have chaplains, well-meaning chaplains, that would call me and say, hey, we want to do this through the department. We're going to get a grant. We're going to do this. I'm like, okay, awesome. And I never hear from them again, you know, and I didn't charge hardly anything back then. I mean, I still don't, but I mean, it was just like, it's like they couldn't get the grant and they couldn't get the buy-in from the departments to, oh, we've got too much to do. We don't really want to deal with the family. But then in 2022, I think the aftermath of 2020 and 2021, they were like, maybe we ought to look at the families. I think for retention, you know, we're losing a lot of officers here because their families are saying, get out. And so let's start doing some stuff for families. And so ever since, we've been really working alongside of and trying to create resources and programs and things that would help departments start family programs and help them support their families in all of this. So that's primarily where we're at today.
And doing a fantastic job of it. I do want one thing I don't think I heard you say is you have some state chapters. I mean, you're growing significantly enough that you have some state chapters now organized and functioning and replicating on a state level what you're doing nationally. Is that right? Did I miss you sharing that?
No, I did not mention that. But yes, that came out of 2020 as well, is because mm-hmm. we were reaching all these different states and we're like, you know, we need boots on the ground because it's different. California is different than Oklahoma, different from Utah, different from Florida, different from Maine. And so we wanted to get their input, but then we also wanted to take How to Love Our Cops through the people. And that is definitely what's happening. We've been able to do some conferences in different states. We have 9 states right now. But we're looking at like four others right now. So nothing in Utah though. So send me somebody.
Yeah.
You get to work in Utah.
Yeah.
But yes, that, and you know what, our state liaisons, I can't say enough of them because they are the heart and soul of what we do. You know, we have, there's a lot of us out here in California, at what we call headquarters. I think we've got about 16 of us out here, but the nine people, I mean, they're kicking ass and taking names. I mean, it's amazing. So, one of the things that's happening, I'll just brag on Washington for right now. So we've got a gal up there who's young. She's been with us kind of from when we started with this. And, she's also a photographer. So she was starting to take pictures for the Academy in, Southern Washington. And so then she said, hey, you know, we have this presentation that we do for those who are just graduating from the Academy, because this is where we're headed. And so we kind of sort of put it together. She did a great job, took it a little further than what we had. And now she's now in talks to have all of the academies, doing a presentation for all of the academies in Washington. Oh, wow. So super cool, because they see the value of it. And we're really right at the beginning. We call it readiness training. You can't, you know, just dump everything. It's gotta be a process. So we've come up with a really good program with Karina's help from Washington, come up with, you know, just enough information to give to these brand newbies, you know, who don't know what they're getting into, and these new families. And then we are, like probably next week on our website, we've got educational videos so different topics. We don't have the gun safety on there yet, but we've got like the transition from civilian to officer, how that affects the home, finances, you know, things that are for those early years, and, you know, how to deal with fear and anxiety, social media. You know, it's different now that you have an officer. So these are the things that we've been putting together, and that comes from our state liaisons. I mean, they've done an amazing job of just taking what we have and even going beyond that. And we do train all of them. So not everybody right now, because we need to have another training, but just about everyone is peer support trained for spouses specifically. So we've done that. And actually Brad was in our first class. He taught our first class. So that was pretty amazing. But so all of us that have roles, are trained in peer support for spouses. So, and that's why we have the helpline with, in partnership with Cortico right now. So yeah, that's how to live our cops. That's it.
Vicki, you're killing it out there. You're doing great. You're doing such great work, and it's amazing. If somebody wanted to get a hold of, we kind of wrap this up. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you or How to Love Our Cops, or reach out or connect, or know what the state liaisons, how do people find out more about How to Love Our Cops, how to find out more about you or your books and all the good stuff about what you're doing?
It's all on the website, which is how2loveourcops.org, and howtolovourcops.org. And that's, you know, you can get a hold of any of us through that. And, you know, you can learn about our helpline if somebody, you know, if a spouse wants to call in and talk to somebody who's been there. I mean, most of the people that we have on our team have been through it. Most of them have had some sort of difficulty. Most of them have critical incidents, and And they've been married for quite a few years, because we don't have a whole lot of really, really young people. We kind of go with more of the mature people who have gone through some stuff. So that's us.
Well, I can personally attest that you and your team are incredible humans, and you do incredible work. Shout out to Lori and Stephanie and Janine and just all of your team, and especially the ones that I've gotten to know have just absolutely been amazing humans and advocating for marriage and raising healthy kids. And Vicky, thank you so much for coming on and talking to our listeners about your passion.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. It was great, Vicky. Awesome to see you again.
Thanks. It's good to see you too, Ben.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.